and no bearing on top, because you're going to have the rocket itself on top. No bearing. But I guess you could call it the equivalent of probably a four. Because the diameter is roughly, I think, 15 feet of the Starliner spacecraft. And then I'm going to have two boosters on it. So. But you'll notice the last two numbers are going to change. They're going to call it a 4-2-2 version, equivalent of a 4-meter fairing. Even so, that fairing's not going to be there. The two is going to be two solid boosters, and then the next two is going to stand for two Centaur upper stage rockets. We're going to have two on board. That'll be the first time they ever change that last number from a 1 to a 2. Pack 2-6.
I noticed that these launch numbers are numbers like 411 and 522 and things like this. And the first number is the number of meters of diameter of the fairing. Does that mean the fairing always comes in exact increments of 1 meter? What would happen if your particular spacecraft required a fairing of 4.5 meters? Would that be called a 411? Or would it be called a 4.511? I'm having trouble believing that the fairings are exact 1 meter.
Or the Atlas V, I've never seen anything except the 4 or the 5. You know, I've never seen like a 3 meter one. But so far it's a 4 and a 5. And yeah, that's it. I guess they know what they have, and then they design the satellites, whatever they are, to fit. You know, if they think they're going to fit into a 4 meter fairing, which they'd like to do, they're going to design it for that. You know, and then everything's built around that. And I guess if they have any extra room, that's where they start getting involved with. Maybe some CubeSats that go up. Everybody launches CubeSats now. It's unbelievable. Now, recently, a couple of days down in South America, they launched another Ariane 5 rocket. And that was pretty cool. That was, now they launched it. They have one big central rocket, and they have two solid boosters coming off of it. Their central rocket is run with liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen, similar to our shuttle system. Let me drop it. So I got to see this launch. Naturally, it wasn't on NASA TV because it had nothing to do with NASA. European Space Agency had it, and to watch this thing go off was they probably launched maybe 70 of these Atlas V in the past. So they're very successful. But on board was the Galileo satellites, not to be confused with the Galileo that we sent to Jupiter, but these are Galileo GPS type of satellites, which are very interesting. They launched two of them. They've launched a couple others in the past. They've got about 12 up there now, and they're going to be put into operation at the end of the year. It'll be a while to find the information on it, but they're going to be free for everybody worldwide. So in the future, your GPS equipment is going to be even more accurate because it's going to work seamlessly. You won't even know what's happening, but it's going to work seamlessly with our GPS system. So I don't know if you've read or heard anything about these Galileo launches that have been going on by the European Space Agency, but billions of dollars, you know, are being spent on this. But it was a real cool launch. Now let me drop it. Short note, within a year and a half or so, we'll be watching one of those same rockets from French Guiana, from South America, taking off with James Webb Space Telescope. So it's good to watch those launches and make sure they're doing good. Because we're going to put this $8 billion telescope on board. Back to you, Dick.
Go right ahead with your question. Give us your call letters, your name, and then your question, sir.
Dick, it's George, KD2FIU. I'm trying to envision, please give me very simple yes or no, this Atlas V, can I envision the launch anything as severe as Saturn V?
Yeah, give us a description of what the Atlas V really is, John. You've given us a engine model number. I think you said it runs on purified kerosene plus, I'm guessing, liquid oxygen. And when it comes to the choice of using fuel of liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen versus kerosene and liquid oxygen, I am guessing that the kerosene plus liquid oxygen is a lot less expensive, only one tank cryogenically cooled as opposed to two, but I'm guessing the energy content is a little bit lower. But that's a bunch of guesses on my part. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I think George also wants to know roughly the size compared to the Atlas, compared to Saturn V. Saturn V was, what, 300 and, I'm going to guess, 360 feet high or something. To give you an idea, the Falcon 9, which goes up, is about 240 feet. This is a little bit less. It's a 100 and, I'll call it 190 or something. For the Falcon 9, you know, the SpaceX launches, if you took a 747 and stood it up, you know, that would be roughly the height if you stood it up on a tail. And if you took a 707 and stood it up, that would be the Atlas V. Atlas V puts out about, if you're going to run, well, this last one had four, when I saw it, had four solid boosters attached to it. I think it generated something like around 2.5 million pounds of thrust dropping. So you're combining the solid booster rockets with the main engine. The main engine rocket is an RD-180. Saturn V had five F-1 engines for that first booster that would take it up. This has one engine, but it's a big engine. If you look at the launch, it gets confusing because you see these two big cones coming out, these two big bells, and it looks like it has two rocket engines on the bottom of it. And it's really one big rocket engine that splits into two combustion chambers. And they call it the RD-180. It's originally built by Russia with some American design behind it. So that's pretty much it. It's kind of copperish looking when you look at it, but right before launch, it's all white, and that's because, like Dick said, the cryogenics that are involved. On the last launch, the thing was coated with ice, and you could see it all falling off even before it took off. Back to you, Dick.
Let's make sure that George has got a mental picture or he's got some further questions. KD1 FIU, K2RIW, go ahead, George.
Thank you, Dick. KD2 FIU, as I recall, looking at Saturn V, it would annihilate the launch pad and just leave a crevice of everything. And good that you mentioned it was five. It was five going off at the time. I don't know it. I haven't seen any of this since then. I just recall Saturn V would leave everything destructed in destruction as it lifted off. Are we seeing this from the Atlas boosters?
Yeah, I'm having a little trouble believing that Launch Pad 39A was destroyed. To be charred, I mean, there's a huge amount of water that was being dumped into the area where the rocket engines were blasting, both to act as an acoustic absorber and also to protect some of the hardware. But I'm having trouble believing that the Launch Pad 39A became a cinder after a launch. I think some damage occurred, but I don't think it was quite that severe. But bring us up to speed on that one, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, they always had some damage that they would repair, but nothing too severe. You know, don't forget, in, you know, they launched, in 1969, they launched two rockets to the moon. People think, oh, we just did the one, we did the Apollo 11. Well, Apollo 12 went up also in 1969, so... You know, Kennedy wanted to get a man on the moon and return him back safely. He actually got four on the moon and returned him back safely before the end of the decade was out. So, and they, whatever damage that they had, they fixed up before Apollo 12 went up. And you asked about the different fuels here. Atlas V has the kerosene fuel. It's refined. I'm not sure what they do to it. They call it refined kerosene fuel, so they call it RP-1, rocket propellant number one. And then they use cryogenically cooled oxygen, liquid oxygen. And that would be the main first stage. Let's forget about the boosters. Let's say we're just launching a rocket without the boosters. And then that gets up, that separates. It's not reusable. They call them Enhanced Evolved Launch Vehicles, EELVs. That's what they refer to. All these vehicles that launch and wind up dumping into the Atlantic or Pacific Ocean. So the next stage ignites, and that has the liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen, and you're right, Dick, that's much more powerful, so...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
And then they can restart it. And they do that many, many times sometimes. One they use is from Aerojet Rocketdyne, which has been around like forever. They use them on the Saturn V rockets, on the S-4B stage. Not the S-1, the correction, the S-1B, the stage that would take them deorbit around the moon and also to bring them back from the moon. That was the liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen rocket. And we use the same variation of that in today's rockets. We use them in the space shuttle for the OMS rocket. They had OMS, the Orbital Maneuvering System. Main purpose for those two big rockets on the back of the space shuttle was to slow themselves down to deorbit, and they were also made by the same company and very effective. When you looked at the back of the shuttle, you saw three big engines, and then near the top you saw two other engines, a little smaller, and then they're the OMS rockets, the Orbital Maneuvering System, and very reliable. Let me drop it. So, you're going to see them in the future for the Atlas rocket for manned launches to the space station in about a year or two. Now, SpaceX is not going to be using that. They use all RP-1 or kerosene and liquid oxygen for the first stage. And when they switch to the second stage, they don't switch over to a hydrogen oxygen mix. They use the exact same fuel. In fact, it's the same engine as the nine engines that they use for launch for the second stage. It's the exact same engine. The only difference is it's rated for vacuum use. It is used in space. It also has a bigger bell, bigger cone coming off the back. Any of the rocket stages that are used in space, the second stage is always in the bigger bell. That's pretty much it. There's a lot of different rockets out there, but they're the basic ones that we're using. Back to you.
When your first stages are fed with purified kerosene plus oxygen, as opposed to liquid oxygen and liquid hydrogen, I'm guessing the kerosene boosted rocket engines are less expensive, more reliable. Only one tank is cryogenically cooled, the liquid oxygen tank. That sounds like a simpler procedure. Do they make that decision for reliability reasons or cost reasons? If that first stage was liquid oxygen and liquid hydrogen, although it's more expensive and more difficult because of twice as much cryogenics, but you've got a higher amount of energy. So it sounds like there's a compromise here between cost, size, and efficiency. So do they use kerosene as often as they could possibly do it in order to save money and to have less cryogenics and therefore get more reliability? How is the decision made to be kerosene fed or liquid hydrogen fed, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Yeah, I would think that kerosene is easier to handle. And of course, liquid hydrogen. We use the liquid hydrogen in the space shuttle. We had one big liquid hydrogen tank and one big liquid oxygen tank to launch the, they were called RS-25 engines. And it's much more powerful. So it's whatever you plan on lifting, more powerful. You get more power in a smaller package. I think each RS-25 on the space shuttle equals just over 500,000 pounds of thrust, if I'm not mistaken. 5 tenths. Yeah, that would be about right. And then the boosters, we had those big solid boosters attached to the space shuttle. So now we're using variations of that for the SLS system that's going to go to Mars. And the SLS system is using, instead of three engines that the space shuttle uses, it's going to use four engines, four RS-25 engine Ds. Almost the same, in fact, in some cases the same engines. And they're going to have boosters attached to it. So each one is roughly 500,000 pounds of pressure. So that came out to 2 million pounds of pressure just with liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen. Let me drop it. Yeah, that gets you up to 2 million. And then each main booster you have, you have two big boosters attached to the SLS system. And it's going to be a little bit bigger than the space shuttle boosters. The space shuttle boosters had four segments, four tin cans in a row lined up, and that was the one booster. Here you're going to have one extra one. You're going to have a fifth one. So it will last a little bit longer. They're going to have a lot more thrust. And each one will be 3 million pounds. So, yeah, those together, you got 6 million plus the 2 million with the four liquid hydrogen ones. And you're going to have an 8 million pound thrust vehicle off the launch pad. So, now, the Ariane 5 that I talked about that just bought up these Galileo GPS satellites. That one runs on, they chose liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen as well, and then they run two solid booster rockets. So I guess it's economics, thrust, size of the vehicle that you're going to use, how long it's going to stay in the launch pad. You can keep RP-1 on the launch pad longer. A lot of factors, I guess, come into play on how they decide on how to design these things. Back to you.
I should know, but I don't. When it comes to liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen, which one is the colder tank that therefore is more likely to create an icing condition? Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, liquid oxygen. I think it's minus 350, I'm going to guess. I think I'm close. I think it's probably 310, 320, but SpaceX brings an extra 50 degrees colder. They call it densification. The colder it is, the denser it is, the more fuel you can get on board. And they do the same thing with the RP-1. They bring that down to a cold of 50 degree temperature lower than what they normally bring it down to. So that's cold. Now they think that that might have contributed to that explosion on September 1st on Launch Complex 40. This whole system that they have, they're bringing it down really too cold to the point where liquid oxygen is starting to solidify. I think it's around minus 370 degrees, something like that. It starts to solidify. They don't want it to solidify. They're bringing it close. But now what I've been reading, what happened, let me drop it. To bring a third gas into this called helium. Now, why helium? When you're burning fuel and then oxygen, especially oxygen, and oxygen is leaving the tank, it has to be replaced by something. These tanks are so flimsy that they need to be, you need the whole pressure inside of the all these tanks. When they're flying, they want to keep it pressurized. To do that, they have these six large helium tanks. When I say large, they're about a meter high, about a half a meter wide, and they're filled up with liquid helium, and they're brought down to like minus 400 degrees, I mean, even colder. So they're thinking that the helium tanks, they actually locate them inside the oxygen tanks, because they're bringing them to a really cold, even colder than the liquid oxygen. The liquid oxygen near the tank is starting to solidify, and these are, they call them carbon-wrapped tanks. They're like aluminum tanks, and then they wrap them with this carbon-wrapped material, and they think that some, let me drop it. They think on the outside of the tank, some of this liquid oxygen is starting to solidify, getting inside the wrapping of the of these helium tanks, and creating some kind of pressure, and defacing the tank, and making it explode. So they're still trying to figure out the ignition source, but I think they think from the sudden bursting of these tanks, which is a tremendous amount of pressure inside, whatever it is, I think that's enough to maybe ignite this as it's expanding, from what I understand. That's the latest. They've been doing some tests down in McGregor, Texas. So I think that's your rough temperatures. I know that it's minus 300, probably, I'm going to guess 350 in that area, give or take 25 degrees back either.
I got it. On technical question for Paul, WHSCDO.
I'm guessing those numbers are really Fahrenheit, not centigrade. Go ahead, Andy, with your question.
Okay, I think you might have read this because I believe you get Scientific American. I was just in the doctor's office this weekend and I was reading a report. Unfortunately, the doctor called me into the office. I couldn't finish the article and then I had to leave the office. But I recall reading in Scientific American about a company, I believe it was Google, planning to invest more than $1 billion in a new fleet of satellites that are going to be mainly used for internet access in areas of the globe that does not have internet capability by cell sites. Did you read anything about this? Because I remember reading this and just want to know if that's going to happen. And I believe the internet as we receive it now wirelessly is only through cell sites and not through satellites at all. Am I correct in saying that? I'll give it back to you for a comment to Paul.
Before I turn it over to Paul, Andy, was that a recent issue of Scientific American? Were you reading the November 2016, or were you reading a much older issue, if you happen to remember? Over to you, Andy.
You know, I didn't look at the date on it, but it was fairly recent because my doctor does not hold on to magazines for a very long period of time. So it was, I would say it's pretty recent, maybe a few months, I believe.
Over to you, Paul, if you want to address that subject. WS2N, K2RIW.
Good evening, Andy. Thank goodness for the doctors. I like going to the doctors. I get to read some of these magazines, pop those signs, and pop the mechanics, and sometimes they have a pretty good discovery there. You know, some of these magazines are so expensive. I like to read one or two articles, maybe one or two months, and then some of the other months I'm not going to read. It's a waste. So you go to the doctor's office, you get to read these things. But yeah, that's Google wants to do it. Then actually SpaceX wants to do it. They're planning on creating a factory where they're going to turn these things out like cars. And I know Google wants to do it too. And you would need, I think they said 900 satellites orbiting the Earth at relatively lower altitudes, like in the 350, 400 mile range. And they're having problems with the FCC approving it because we have a lot of satellites in geosynchronous orbit. Let me drop it. That they think that these satellites might interfere with their transmissions coming back on similar frequencies. I forget what bands they're using. Dick probably knows, but whatever they're using, they might conflict with it. Now they're saying that they're going to use different kinds of antennas, phased arrays. And I don't know. They have some problems convincing the FCC that this is going to be a good idea. But I think it's going to happen. They expect, a couple of billion people that can't get internet across the world to be able to get this. And because they're low in the, space station is 250. I think these are going to be around 350, 400. So not that low, but it's not geosynchronous. You're not going to have this time loss going up to a satellite that's 23,000 miles up. You're not going to have that, maybe 300-400 miles up. So you won't have a time lag. But imagine 900 satellites, flying around, talking to one another. Let's say I'm in Malaysia somewhere. It's just a place I talk to this one satellite. It'll talk to other satellites and go down to wherever it's got to go to. This is all planned on. A lot of companies want to launch these things, including SpaceX, wants to build them and launch them. And I believe I'll have to check. I think it's Virgin Galactic. I think they're the ones that wanted to deal with Google. I'll have to check. But they definitely plan on doing this. Let me drop it. You might remember Virgin Galactic. It's run by that billionaire, Richard Branson. He's the one that's building the spaceship too. He wants to send passengers up on suborbital flights. Well, he's also developed a system called Launcher One. Launcher One is going to be a rocket that he's going to be able to drop from a 747, his own 747. He retired one of his many jets. He owns Virgin Airlines. So he took one of his jets, and now he's developing it as a carrier jet that he's going to carry Launcher One on. So he'll take this rocket, which is under development now, and he'll be able to put, a couple of these satellites on at a time and fly it up to any inclination he wants and send these things into orbit. So there's a tremendous amount of money to be made launching these things. And is it called Next One? I'm trying to remember the name of the satellite program. They actually have a name for this thing. I could probably Google it. I forgot. Back to you, Dick. WSMI.
Now, along the line of what Andy is asking, this Google system that's going to fill in the areas where people do not have internet coverage, and there's a lot of places in both the United States and the rest of the world where there's very poor coverage, are these satellites going to transmit a radio signal directly to the internet customer or to a local gateway station that then creates a hot zone on their cell phone or whatever. So what do you believe is going to be the Google system, directly to the customer or to some kind of gateway stations? WS2N, K2RIW.
I would imagine you could probably go direct, but yeah, gateway would probably be the way to go, but you're in the middle of the desert somewhere, and it's not going to be a gateway for you to go to, so you would have to go directly to the satellite.
Okay, that means now the internet customer has to have an X-band or S-band or KU-band radio system capable of talking to a satellite. From indoors in a big building, that could be a problem. There's a problem of establishing that kind of an antenna, enough uplink power, proper aiming of the antenna. For people in a developing nation to establish all of that hardware and accuracy strikes me as a bit of an impediment there, Paul. Do you think that this is a well-thought-out plan and they've got a way of solving those problems? WS2N, K2RIW.
I know these are proposed plans. I don't think they have any satellites coming off the factory floor, but I know they want to do something similar to making cars to make these things. So somebody must have thought it out to the point where they're going to be doing it. Gateway system, and well, if you had a gateway, you wouldn't need the satellites, right? You'd send that gateway directly into the internet from wherever you are. What would the purpose of that be? I would imagine these things would have to be independent. I don't know. I haven't looked at that far into it. I'm more interested in these 900 satellites that are going to get up there and who's going to put them there than the operations of the satellites themselves. But I would think that they'd have to have some kind of direct connection. Why couldn't you have it similar to a cell phone system? Hook up. Why do you need this? I don't think you're going to need this elaborate antenna system with 900 antennas flying all over. You could probably do it with a cell phone, not a cell phone, but something a little bit more powerful than a cell phone to maybe pushing 4 or 5 watts. I bet it would work.
Comment?
Yeah, comment. I'll pick you up in a minute. Paul, there's a huge difference here. Your local cell phone talks to a cell phone base station on the average 3 miles away. When you're talking to a medium orbit satellite at 500 miles, 400 miles above you, that's a huge difference in free space laws. And the satellite might not want to use cell phone frequencies. You might want to use much higher frequencies where the antennas are more precisely aimed. So for a customer to talk directly to a satellite,
repeater, timeout.
If the satellite is directly overhead, maybe it's 400 miles. But on average, the satellite is not directly overhead. The one you're talking to is at some slant range, 500, 600, 700 miles. You get a huge difference in free space loss of 500, 600 miles compared to 3 miles. So therefore, talking directly to the satellite, as I see it, you've got some really strong uplink and downlink problems to establish enough signal-to-noise ratio over that greater range. The average ground station talking to a satellite is a great big antenna. You see what I'm worried about here, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Yeah, again, I haven't thought that out. I just know that these things are under development. So, if they have this gateway set up, it's not going to help you out. If you're on a boat, floating around in my boat, and out in the middle of the China Sea somewhere, and I got to be able to Google something. I won't be able to do it unless I talk directly to that satellite. That's the way I think of it. How they go about it is, I haven't figured this out yet. Haven't read enough about it. There was another station that had a question or a comment.
Yeah, comment station. Please identify yourself and go ahead with your question. K2RIW.
K2RIW, KD2FIU. It's George. Dick, you pretty much responded as I am. We have a propagation delay with dealing with satellite, even if they are in low-level orbit. And I don't know if the initial... I'm not speaking for the companies doing this. I don't know if the initial layout is going to be for the individual subscribers' access to it. It may be for nodes. I don't know. I'm not speaking for them. But maybe from nodes to get to it. Let me recycle the repeater. However, if you are an individual who's out there on the water and is going to be accessing directly into satellite network, be prepared to say over and wait for a response. And everybody had better be prepared to say over and wait for a response because you have that delay. If they're going to build this, they're going to be replacing... If, I'm not speaking for them, I'm only imagining they're going to be replacing a tremendous amount of fiber optic that is laid around the world in the oceans, which is far more faster.
OneWeb is what it was called, by the way, Dick. OneWeb.
Yeah, I just did a quick calculation, Paul. Assuming that your communication link directly from an internet customer to a satellite... and that satellite is at 400 miles altitude, and you're talking to it at a slant range where the total path is 500 or 600 miles, versus a cell phone which talks 3 miles on average. 3 miles versus 500 miles, that ratio is 44 more dB of space loss one way. That number rolls off the tongue real easily. You establish enough signal-to-noise ratio. Your cell phone runs a fraction of a watt to talk 3 miles. And now you've got to make that signal 44 dB stronger to talk with the same signal-to-noise ratio to a satellite 500 miles away. That's a serious technical problem. So I'm having trouble believing that this proposed system is going to be directly from satellite to customer. I mean, there was a space phone system of S-band, I can't remember the name of the darn thing, which turned out to be economically not feasible. Why can't I think of the name of that darn cell phone system of about 10 years ago? Anyhow, that range is not easy to accomplish. Whereas if you're talking from that satellite to a ground station, and the ground station becomes the distribution for the surrounding few hundred miles, by cell phone-like system, now you stand a chance. That ground station I just described is called a gateway. But to talk from customer directly to that satellite, that doesn't come easily, Paul, unless it's a really potent satellite. WS2N, K2RIW.
AC2QIQ with a comment.
Yeah, and they shot.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Just looked it up. This is the one with Richard Branson. He's on the... He's one of the board of directors. Yeah, you got to look up OneWeb. So, I guess that's probably the main way they're going to do it, if not the only way. Back to you, Dick.
KC2QIQ, wait for the beeps and go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, good evening, Dick. I'm not sure that this is really as difficult as it sounds, because I know SiriusXM radio doesn't require a very difficult antenna on the cars to receive satellites all the time. And keep in mind, this is not a real-time telephone. This is going to be data for internet. So there, you can allow a certain amount of delay time for the data to reach the phone or the computer that's receiving it. Now back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
In the case of XM radio, Paul, Glenn, audio is being sent down. You and I can remember back in the days when you had a telephone hookup to the internet, and that was an audio system transmitting data, and you remember how slow that was. The kind of data rates that we almost demand for internet connections these days, which is transmitting video. You need 30 dB more signal to do that. So the fact that XM does it with a highly digitized and compressed audio, those telephone hookups that we used to use, by modern day standards, that was awfully slow. You see what I'm worried about here, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Comment. Yeah, absolutely, Dick. I'm with you, but I think also, keep in mind, data on phones is a little bit different than the data on a full home-blown computer or a laptop. So the amount of internet data that's on your cell phone is considerably video limited. In other words, they don't give you the full bandwidth on your phone when you're connected up through a cell network at 800 megahertz. So, you know, here again, I think it's quite feasible. And there again, they're not guaranteeing, you know, super duper up and download speed. They're just trying to deliver internet. Back to you, Dick. K2IW, KC2QIQ.
WS1, they talk about progressive pitch here, by the way, Dick, on how to avoid the interference with the equatorial satellite.
Okay, there's another person who wanted to make a comment, and maybe that was George. Over to that comment person.
Yeah, into JFL. Well, they only have an internet-based satellite up-downlink company, but it's only out in the southern United States that's available out in the Midwest there. So, I mean, they already have the uplink-downlink going down to a dish. So, I mean, they have it there already available. Are you guys skipping over that one? Into JFL. Name's Jeff.
Comment. Okay, Jeff, that's a new one on me. Who's comment? Go ahead.
Thank you, Dick. It's George, KD2FIU. Be prepared to say over and pause for any voice communication like that to happen. And keep in mind that when we have a cellular communication, the max that you're going to have is a few miles for it to be effective without any propagation delay. I'm not saying this won't work, but you're going to be asking companies to replace or to make more cost effective. Let me recycle the repeater. Ask them to replace systems and facilities that are in effect right now that are more cost worthy. We're not getting 5G because nobody has enough facilities to put it on every pole, on every block, in every middle of every block. Nobody has that money to do that. No communications companies have that money to do that. If you want to say, we're going to put this up in 900, 1,000, 1,900, 2,900, 9,000 satellites with FCC approval, of course, what is going to make it cost effective for them to do it to override the facilities that are in place right now? Because the delay is going to be incredible. I know, I worked on it. KD2FIU.
Yeah, let me try to clear up the word delay or latency here, George. There's two different kinds of latency. Back in the days when we tried to use geosynchronous satellites at 22,300 miles for telephone conversations, we had a third of a second delay up and down in one direction, and then the guy is re-answering you, another third of a second up and down delay for his answer to come back to you. And so very frequently you would end up both talking and both listening without using the word over. Those delays became very complicated. When you get down to satellites not at 22,000 miles, but a couple of hundred miles, the delay is so small you almost don't hear it. However, we have all experienced a lot of delay on modern cell phone systems. That's not because of propagation delay. That is latency of the digitizing function of the cell phone itself. That's a different kind of delay. So an awful lot of that over-requirement is not because of radio propagation. That's digital delay because of these highly speech-compressed systems. That's what I think is going on there, George. Maybe you've got a different opinion on this one. KD2FIU, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Very good point. Very good point, because you're getting into the shorter distances. Dick, who is going to put in that much money? Who is going to put in that much money? Think about it. There are other technologies right now that the companies are sitting on because they cannot take up enough deployment of space products. I look at it and say, if we're going to have individual devices contacting with us on real time, it's a way out. It's a way out because there's a lot of other facility means that are in place that have not been fully utilized yet. KD2FIU.
I just want to add one more thing, then I have to go.
Do it direct. Partially, Dick.
Go ahead, Andy.
I'm actually looking up on the internet now, just doing a little bit of research on this, but because I do recall, you know, again, I was pressed for time because I was in a doctor's office, and yeah, Paul, you're right. That's a good place to read. It did go on to say that as of today, I believe, at least 2/3 of the world's population do not have any internet access. And it said 2/3, and I'm looking at an article right now from Scientific American, but I don't know how far back this goes. And it also says 2/3 of the world's population. That's a lot, 2/3. I didn't think it was that much. But getting back to this delay business, these satellites are going to be approximately 5,000 miles as opposed to 22,000 miles, as Paul mentioned. And it goes into saying that the difference in altitude results in corresponding difference in delays. While some satellite users contend with the 150 millisecond delay, that's 150 milliseconds delay in their internet coverage, the time it takes for radio, there's a quote, the time it takes for radio signals to go back and forth between the base carrier station and the satellite. So that's 150 milliseconds. Those with other services might experience 600 millisecond delays for the same service. And that's going to cause a problem. Such a delay, they said, is considerable and is excessive and will not be good for business use on the internet. So there you go with the delay that you were talking about, Dick. All right, to be continued, I got to go because I have to go to work. But I have to look more into the subject. It is interesting. Back to you, Dick. W8CDO.
W8CDO, repeater. Time out.
Go ahead, Glenn. I'll wait for the beeps.
Yeah, I think to answer the cost question with Branson, is that what used to make satellites so expensive in the past was that you had to pay NASA to put your satellite up there. Now you have Branson, he's got his own space company, so he can do his own launches, and he can set up his own satellites. So if he's personally funding it, he can do it by himself without other investors, and he can get investors to help offset the cost. Let me let it drop for a second. And the other thing to keep in mind is that if it's a direct system, and even if he does allow some conversion, dishes on the ground to help out other locations, for like buildings and other things, he's getting around all the taxation issues. You know, keep in mind, when you're an internet company, you've got to buy it through AT&T, Verizon, whoever you're, cable. So there's all those taxes and everything else involved. They're bypassing that all direct. So there's a lot of money that they can be putting in their own pockets. KC2QIQ, back to you, Dick.
JFL comment?
JFL recognized. Iridium, I think, is the name of the satellite system that was put up something like 15 years ago. And it was supposed to talk from satellite directly to the customer. to a handheld radio, great big brick-like thing. And it became economically unreliable, impractical. And I think the military bought the system and they're using it. They can afford it. But as a commercial system, it didn't work. And so what's different with this new one is an interesting question. N2, is it Juliet, Foxtrot, Lima, Jeff? Do I have you call this correct? Over here, Jeff, K2RIW.
And pick up Rich, K2UPS, and then leave some time. There's another person on EchoLink.
Roger. You got it, Jeff.
N2JFL. Well, it was SearsNet that I was actually looking into a few years ago, and they were using the satellite downlink with a phone uplink. Now they've created it uplink and downlink, but unfortunately it's only available out in the Midwest, southern Midwest. So if you guys look up HughesNet, you'll see all about it. And they put up a couple more satellites that can do both down and uplink. But again, you need the dish pointing up there in the southeast to get it. Over to you there, Rich, N2JFL.
K2UPS, K2RIW, you got it, Rich.
Okay, Dick, thank you. KCBS Mobile, Pennsylvania. I had looked into HughesNet myself a while ago, but those are geosynchronous. It's not what this system is talking about now. And I just did a real quick glance on the Internet for OneWeb and the Wikipedia site. Now, of course, we all know how accurate that information can be. But they were discussing it that these satellites would be at 750 miles up, operating on a KU band, and the user on the Earth would need an antenna that was approximately 14 by 16 inches. And that was just a quick 30-second glance that I gave it. So, I mean, there are some people that are going really into depth here, asking all sorts of questions. Take a few minutes, look it up, read it, and you'll probably have a lot of your answers there, because you're arguing points that maybe don't need to be argued. But if you're discussing the OneWeb setup, which is, I think, the one that he mentioned, that's supposed to be set up at 750 miles and on the KU band. Dick, back to you.
The US to land, yeah. I found a picture with an antenna on a school building.
Yeah, I see some problems here. To take a person without internet connection living in a developing nation, and he's got to put up this KU band antenna, the uplink transmitter, downlink receiver. That's a lot of hardware. That doesn't sound inexpensive. Yeah, in the early days of satellite reception, the systems in the beginning were very expensive, and eventually we got KU band direct TV with your 18-inch dish, and those systems became a hell of a lot cheaper. So it's possible, but if the satellite is not geosynchronous, then that KU band antenna has to either be mechanically or electronically aimable. I mean, just because you got a big enough antenna is great, but it's got to be aimed at a moving satellite. So there are details here that don't sound like they're thoroughly worked out yet. Is a guess on my part, but maybe as you research it on the internet, you may have a different impression now, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, this has come from the OneWeb site, and I haven't looked at the Wikipedia that Rich talked about, but the OneWeb site is, you know, they have all the things you can go to. You know, the solutions, the technology, the people that are involved. And one of the things is direct to home or school or health center, and it looks like the size of the antenna, it looks like it's probably about the same size as what Rich has been talking about. Almost looks like it's enclosed in a plastic thing, and then two solar panels sticking out from the side of it. I guess that's going to drive it in the middle of nowhere where somebody doesn't have electricity or something, have it attached to a small school. So I guess everybody inside is going to use the same thing to link through this one unit to go direct to the satellites. Back to you, Dick.
John, did you say there's another person that wants to check in with us? KC2WGB, K2IW.
Dick was taken care of.
Okay.
solve everything. But if you're putting up such a large number of satellites all at a similar altitude, how do you make sure they never hit each other when they're doing these fancy figure eight patterns in space, so to speak? In other words, the orbits periodically are crossing each other at the almost right angles. And so there's eventually going to be some crashes. And one single crash in space is nowhere near as simple as a simple crash of two vehicles on the ground. Two vehicles on the ground, you go over there and pick up all the pieces. You do two crashes in space, you make thousands of little particles that are all in separate orbits. And boy, you make an awful lot of space junk. So you want to really make sure that two satellites in space never hit each other. And that's another difficult problem to be solved as I see it. Anybody with any further comments, give me your call letters right now. K2IW and the TechNet.
QFRU.
Okay, I heard George second, but the first one was K1 something or other. Go ahead to
K1. K1 MJM, Mike, number two. Iridium is still alive and well, the system is still up there. And they did have a satellite crash last year. I don't think it was a Chinese satellite, I think it was last year. K1 MJM, back over to you, Dick.
So very fine, Mike. So Iridium is still flying, but owned by the government. It wasn't economically viable. So as a commercial product, it didn't make it. But was it Iridium? Are you telling me that Iridium has had a interceptor, Mike? K1 FJM, K2RIW? K1 MJM. Go ahead, Mike.
Roger, Dick. Yeah, it was an Iridium satellite last year. They have amateurs up there for the constellation, but one of them collided, I believe, with a Chinese, maybe Paul can add to it, maybe he knows more than me. But no, Iridium still, it's not government owned, it's public stock, but it's still Iridium. I'm working on a high altitude balloon project, and we're using the Iridium system for communication.
Very interesting. Over to you, George, wait for the beeps. KD2FIU, K2RIW.
K2RIW, KD2FIU, and yes, for all of those satellites, and more as they multiply, they would need to be in a cellular transmission fashion with more RF for them to communicate with each other, not only communicating our signals to be passed as they pass, but for those satellites to communicate with each other, for them to not possibly crash into each other. And wouldn't we be amazed to find out that if there were health reasons, I don't know what we would do at that point. KD2FIU.
You said health reasons. Are you talking about the personal hardware owned by the end user radiating signals that represent health? Because I'm pretty sure you're not talking about the space hardware creating a radio frequency biohazard. So I'm not quite sure what you mean by health reasons. So I guess you're saying the KU band uplink you think might represent a health reason, a health issue. Back to you on that one, George. K2RIW.
Yes, for your signal, Dick, to travel whatever it is, 3, 4, 5, 7, 800 miles, 1,000 miles, it would need to be more powerful. I'm sorry, I didn't clarify that. We're going on between the units in space to keep them in a synchronous movement is probably no greater than what the sun is doing to us. However, to travel that distance versus the 3, 4, 5, 10, and maybe 15 miles to a cell phone tower from a cell phone is nothing compared to that. I just don't know what is going to happen at those frequencies and the power required. KD2FIU.
Now, the most sensitive part of a human being is the eye. The eye has a thermal time constant of roughly 6 minutes. So when it comes to assessing radio frequency biohazard, when you're standing near a transmitter, you have to integrate the amount of RF power the human being gets over a 6-minute period. Now, possibly the packets can be brought up, can be broken up in such a way that the transmission occurs for a few seconds.